It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2024 returning MOI Global Instructor Amit Wadhawani, Portfolio Manager and co-founding partner at Moiris Capital Management and the founding manager of the Moiris Worldwide Value Fund. Amit has more than three decades of experience researching and analyzing investment opportunities in developed, emerging, and frontier markets. He has managed global investment portfolios since 1996. Prior to founding Moiris, Amit was a portfolio manager and partner at Third Avenue Management. He founded the international business and at Third Avenue and was the founding manager of three internationally oriented funds. Earlier in his career, Amit was first a securities analyst and then director of research at MJ Whitman, a New York-based broker-dealer. He was also a paper and forest products analyst at Canadian brokerage firm Bunting Warburg. And Amit began his career at Domtar, a Canadian forest products company. He holds an MBA in finance from the University of Chicago, also has a BA with honors and an MA in economics from Concordia University. And finally, Amit holds BS degrees in chemical engineering and mathematics from the University of Minnesota. Amit, such a great pleasure to have you with us again. Your presentations always add tremendous value to myself and the MOI Global community. So thank you for that, and thank you for taking the time to be with us again today. I would now like to turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John, for your very kind introduction. Welcome to all of those who are listening at the present time or are joining us at a later date. I hope all of you and yours are keeping safe and doing well. Before I start, let me just pause at the disclaimer, which is this mass of verbiage, which is on the screen at this time. So I'll leave it up there for a moment so you have you can review it. Please note in particular the very last sentence. The following information is not being provided in a fiduciary capacity and it is not intended to be and should not be considered as impartial investment advice. Please do take those words seriously, and because they really do, you know, and because they should be. Okay. Now, before I get to the idea at hand, there's a few words, especially for those unfamiliar, about how we at Moiris pick securities. In particular, what constitutes attractive opportunities when viewed through our lenses as disciplined value investors. So let me just go into the next slide. Let me summarize the contents of the slide because there's lots of things in here, especially the three headings is a long-term focus, an owner's mentality, and a deep discount is paramount. So what am I trying to say by this? We are opportunistic investors, first and foremost, who endeavor to buy individual stocks as representing parts of businesses at a valuation below what an acquirer would be willing to pay for the same entity in its entirety. This requires us to be opportunistic, price sensitive, and willing to buy when others are not. For example, during periods of market dislocations. And very importantly, we are long-term. Usually 3 to 5 years at the outset is a normal investment horizon for us. So anything I speak about today should be viewed in the context of a long holding period. Now, one of the distinctive characteristics of our approach to security selection is how we approach the valuation of a security. Unlike most investors, we are skeptical of our ability to forecast earnings with an accuracy enough to risk our clients and our own money on it, on these forecasts, that is. Given that we are long-term investors, we would have to forecast earnings 5 or more years into the future, which is an even more daunting task. So we approach the valuation problem slightly differently. What would a security be worth if you were to sell off the assets or the respective businesses, pay off the encumbrances, and distribute the remainder to the shareholders? making sure that the valuations of the assets was done using conservative assumptions rooted in the here and now, and the methodology was similarly conservative in nature. This is what we call our asset-based approach to investing. Two important characteristics, two actually qualifiers to what I've said. Such severely discounted valuations, the kind we seek, are typically found during periods of adversity. So for value to be recognized or surface, such adversity must pass and the company must emerge largely unscathed. This requires a careful assessment of the risks associated with the business to ensure that the company will survive, or actually preferably thrive, through this period of adversity. The second qualifier is that this investment approach requires time for the factors affecting the business and depressing the stock price to abate. In essence, this approach necessitates long-term investment horizons, as I mentioned earlier. This is almost anachronistic in this day and age of high turnover investing. But this too should underline the importance of a good financial position and the survivability of the company. The investment I plan to discuss today is an Australian listed stock, which owns or controls multiple distinct entities. It is effectively a holding company, or holdco for short. Let me say a few words about holdcos and their attraction to our kind of analysis. To my mind, one of the potential attractions of holdcos is their ownership of multiple standalone assets or businesses. These separate businesses can be grown or developed separately, and their values realized independently and opportunistically. This manner of value crystallization can typically offer multiple sources of value generation for shareholders. You know, this slide, this very first slide in holdcos, basically refers to the characteristics of a holdco, generically speaking. The second one is a sort of brief checklist for investing in holding companies. And these are sort of characteristics we'd like to see investing in a company which we would consider to be a holdco. I mean, is there an attractive discount? Are the holdco operating expenses modest? In terms of the financial strength, is the holding company itself financially well capitalized? Are the holdings then unto themselves operationally strong enough to cope with adversity? Of course, then also there's the quality of the dominant shareholders, stewardship of the assets. So this is really a very quick checklist, a generic one, to see if a holdco meets the characteristics we need for investment. As a starter, let me just sort of give you a high-level overview of the investment idea today, and then we can sort of drill down into it. The name of the company is Cromwell Property Group, Cromwell or CMW for short. It is an Australian company. The common shares of Cromwell, which trade in the exchange, Sydney Exchange, are a stapled unit comprising a unit that owns properties and another unit that owns the management company. As the name suggests, Cromwell Property Group is a property company. It owns high quality office properties in Australia, has investments in real estate funds that it controls and manages, manages a range of types of real estate assets. Notably, the direct investments here that I refer to relates to actual businesses, buildings that they own in Australia. The indirect investments are holdings in various entities that they manage. And then there's, of course, the funds and asset management business. Now, as you will see, there's a lot of stuff going on over here. I mean, this lack of business and geographic focus, combined with an inflated cost structure and a somewhat extended balance sheet, has led to a number of years of relatively indifferent financial and stock price performance. I mean, this ultimately, of course, if you have years and years of underperformance, you're going to wind up with an undervalued stock. And this is sort of funny because Australia is a fairly well-picked over market, and most real estate companies, REITs in particular, especially in the world of which have business commercial office space, tend to trade at premiums to their net tangible assets. What caught our eye about this company was that ARA Asset Management, a very large global real estate manager, which is actually a company we spoke about in this very forum, in January 2021, launched a proxy fight to gain control of the board. I mean, this very public and often acrimonious fight lasted the better part of 3 years, with the ARA representatives finally gaining representation on the board in early 2021. The longtime MD and managing director and chief executive officer resigned at the end of 2020, paving the way for ARA to begin to reshape the company. Given the protracted, and I'd say protracted because it's a three-year struggle that ARA went through to gain control, clearly it sees something of value to be gotten and is in the pursuit of exactly that. While this is very much a work in progress, the newly installed board and management is expected to narrow the focus of the business, while crystallizing some of the latent value embedded in these shares with the attendant benefits to CMW shareholders. This is by way of a very high-level background about the company and how we arrived here. Let's turn to the company itself. Functionally, the company can be divided into three parts, as you will see from this chart. First, is direct investments in property, which comprises high-quality property assets in the Australian office property market, rented to various arms of the Australian government and other high-quality tenants. The second is indirect investments, which consists of Cromwell's investments in funds that it controls and manages across a variety of assets, principally in Europe. And the third box here is the funds and asset management business, where the company managed about 11.5 billion Australian dollars in property and investment funds at the end of June 2023. Let us now look a bit more closely at the various activities of this company. Now, turning first to the direct investments, which are the various properties that Cromwell Properties owns, let me highlight a few things. Now, you see in this table, there are a number of properties that are listed here, and the portfolios are categorized three ways: core, core plus, and active. Core is exactly what, as the word suggests, a keeper. And core plus is, properties where the company is working on to improve the rents or assets, that they're repositioning the building in the market and so forth. And active, which are properties which are undergoing significant renovations or transitions. Now, properties in this last category of active are vacant and do not generate much income. As you will see from this table, there is only one active property in this portfolio at the present time, which is really land for development. And it's also the lowest value. It's a very, very small part of the asset base here. The next thing to note, of course, here is where these properties are located. I mean, these are in primary locations, such as Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Canberra. For example, if you look at the state, I've listed them really by state, the first two properties are in Queensland, which is Brisbane, which is where these first two office buildings are located. The next number of properties are New South Wales, and these are all in Sydney. The following ones are ACT, which is the capital region, which is namely Canberra. And finally, you have Collins Street, which is in Melbourne, Victoria. Okay, so these are prime locations. The largest tenants of these properties are various arms of the government, be it the Commonwealth of Australia, the New South Wales government, the Queensland government, the Department of Meteorology, and other high-quality counterparties. You know, for example, Qantas has its headquarters in one of these buildings in Sydney. I mean, so, you know, when you have such quality tenants, and I suppose solvent ones at that, what is noteworthy is the resilience of the portfolio vis-a-vis rent collections. These were in the order of 95% during the pandemic and after, despite the various shutdowns and the work-from-home mandates that were issued. Now, the other item I want to flag on this chart, which is sort of kind of important, is the external valuation by property. And the cap rates that we use for each of these income-generating properties, obviously with the exception of the land. Now, so One thing to note is cap rates have gone up, sort of in line with, of course, the rapidly rising interest rates. There, as here, the Reserve Bank of Australia was no slouch in raising rates, and there were succession rate hikes. Now, this in turn resulted in the increase in cap rates, and it resulted in a lowering of the carrying values of these properties. All things considered, though, I would say the range of capitalization rates that you see in this table is generally reasonable. It's neither draconian nor is it too low. So it's sort of kind of a Goldilocksy kind of thing. It's kind of not too hot, not too cold, and it's a reasonable kind of cap rate again. Now, the thing about that worries people when they look at commercial property is, of course, people just running away from them, basically the work from home and so forth. So we've had a major phase when people did work from home. There were work from home mandates, and people have been returning. And importantly, in this case, in the case of these tenants, it's a fairly high occupancy rate, as you will see in the next chart. If you look at the next chart, the occupancy rate right now, in fact, the vacancy rate is a little bit north of 5%. The lease expiration schedule that you see here has very minimal expirations in 2024. They rise in 25 and 26. But given the tenant quality, the cash flows, and the location of these buildings, the cash flow stream seems reasonably safeguarded against imminent interruption. I mean, 2027, of course, is a sort of a large lease expiration year, but we are some ways from that. We're three odd years away from this timeline. So, as you can see, the lease expiration schedule by the net leased area is relatively undemanding. Now, turning now to the indirect investments, there really are four. There's the Central European REIT, there's the Cromwell Polish Retail Fund, there's the Cromwell Italian Urban Logistics Fund, and there's the Cromwell Direct Property Fund, all of which, of course, are advised by Cromwell. Okay, so now Cromwell European REIT, which actually of which Cromwell owns 28% of the outstanding shares, is a Singapore-listed REIT which owns properties across Europe, primarily office and light industrial and logistics properties. This is not a highly leveraged REIT with its REIT leverage within this sort of board-approved range of 35% to 40%. So it's a relatively lightly leveraged REIT. So there, and it's doing reasonably well. And the way we val well, we'll get back to get to valuations in a moment. But the attributable value in the column on the right-hand side gives you the value attributable to Cromwell of its holding in the in the indirect specific indirect investment. So the value of its holding for the purposes of the attributable value is $362 million Australian dollars here for this. The second thing is the Cromwell Polish Retail Fund, which Cromwell owns 100% of. It bought out the other shareholders late 2019, and CPRF, which is the Cromwell Polish Retail Fund, owns 100% of six shopping centers and has a significant interest in a seventh. While it is currently 100% owned by Cromwell, it is expected that there will be a sale of a portion, likely a majority holding, in a not-too-distant future. The potential sale has entered the due diligence stage with a prospective buyer, so this may or may not be long for the world. There is, and we will talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Then there's the Cromwell Italian Urban Logistics Fund, of which they own 50%. Cromwell owns 50% of the logistics fund following the sale of the other half to Value Partners, which is a Hong Kong-based investment management firm. The core of this portfolio is a collection of seven logistics centers in northern Italy, which are fully let to DHL for a term of 10-plus years. So this is quite a, you know, an income-generating portfolio. The original idea was for this portfolio to be used as seed capital for a new fund that Cromwell was going to launch called the Cromwell European Logistics Fund. To date, this has not taken place, and Cromwell continues with his 50% holding in this company as of now. So, I mean, those are the bulk of the holdings in the, and then, of course, you have the 4% ownership of the Cromwell Direct Property Fund, which is like sort of a stub, and the attributed value here is about $16.5 million. So then to the last business, the third business, which is the asset management business. What this slide shows is the AUM in Cromwell's funds and asset management business, and its EBIT during the period from fiscal 2015 to the end of fiscal 2023. I should make a couple of caveats here. One, these revenues have benefited from some non-recurring revenues, such as transaction revenues and performance fees. The other observation that I would make is that notwithstanding this being a very, very attractive business unto itself, the now departed management, the one that resigned in 2020, was rather more interested in expanding its geographic reach and transacting in properties rather than building these financial metrics, especially the funds and asset management business. You will notice, of course, that this is a reasonably steady generator of earnings, as such a business would be, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, because this is potentially a very, very important part of Cromwell going forward. Now, you know, most real estate companies come with debt. I mean, there are very few real estate companies which do not have debt, and they are few and far between. Now, what this chart shows is the summary debt maturity schedule. As you will see, there's relatively limited debt maturities in 2024. So there is a window to prepare for the maturities in 2025. The 2025 maturities are roughly evenly divided between Australia, where these liabilities, the debt, is supported by the cash flow being generated by the office properties they have in Australia, which are generally pretty well leased up. And so refinancing that should not be a problem per se. And then the other chunk of debt maturing in 2025 is that which is relating to the indirect holdings. A rationalization of the indirect holdings, notably Poland, which I mentioned, where there's a meaningful asset which has been put up for sale. Sale of that asset would basically would address a considerable portion of the 2025 maturities. 2026 has a de minimis maturities, as you can see. So really, I think a lot sort of depends on what is done with the sale of assets in Poland. The other element of debt is not just its maturities, but the covenants. Now, this table summarizes the covenants of the different tranches of debt. As you will see, if you look through these, in most cases, there's a reasonable amount of headroom. Let's just take the first one, the senior secured facility. The covenant, of course, the first covenant is LVR, which is the loan-to-value ratio. The actual number is 48.2%, where, you know, of course, subject to a limit of 60%. So the property would really have to be shellacked and written down a whole bunch more for it to actually hit the 60% limit. The second item here is the weighted average lease expiration. The 5.3 years is the actual amount, whereas what you see here is the limit is actually 3 years. So the, again, headroom here too. And the interest coverage ratio, which of course the prescribed amount, the limit is two times, whereas the current number is actually three times. If you look through the remainder of these covenants, you will see that there's reasonable headroom in each of those. So, and the last two of them, of course, the CPRF refers to the Polish retail fund. In both cases, these will start to disappear if the sale of that asset takes place. So I note that this is There is headroom here. I mean, it's, how should I say this? It's okay, but it's not super comfortable. But if the asset sales of the European holdings proceed, this is going to start to ease and ease considerably. So far, we've now talked about the assets, the liabilities, the businesses of Cromwell. Let's see what this whole thing, if you put it all together, what does it look like and what's it worth? Now, I apologize for this table. This table is relatively fine print, for which I apologize. And we have a summary table on the next page in a moment, which we'll turn to. Very quickly, the first line really is the direct properties. The assessed value is based upon the weighted average cap rate of 5.7%. The second are the indirect investments. There are four of them, as I noted. The first one was Cromwell European REIT, which, of course, we carried at market, which is actually below Cromwell's own carrying value. Then there's the Cromwell Polish Retail Fund. Now, as I mentioned, this Cromwell Polish Retail Fund, there are discussions to in terms of purchasing it, and the bid price, it has been written down to the expected bid price. Okay, so that's the indicative bid level to which we've written it down to in this valuation. Then there's the Cromwell Italian Urban Logistics Fund. This valuation is based on what the other 50% was sold to value partners at. And then, of course, there's a small number, which is the Cromwell Direct Property Fund. So that's the indirect investments. The asset management business we value at 10 times trailing 12 months EBIT, which is not an unreasonable number. Most of these things actually trade at higher valuations, but that's how we get this number. Then the odds and ends are the remaining assets. There's the other assets, cash. We net out the debt. We get, you know, of course, all the debt. There's no dividend payable as of the fiscal 2023. And then there's the NAV. Let's just go to the next chart, which is it's a bit clearer here. Okay, so all this does is summarize the indirect investments, and basically it's in larger types so people can read it. So where we come to here is the NAV per unit is 89 cents, 0.89 cents. The current price, actually as of last night's close, was 37.5 cents per share, which is, you know, that's, you know, it's actually about a 58% discount to the NAV. If you believe in using the reported NTA, which is the accounting net tangible assets per unit, which was 84 cents, you're at a 55.5% discount to that. So what you can see, of course, is that Cromwell shares are deeply, deeply undervalued in relation to the NAV, in relation to the stated net tangible assets. Now, this is all very well and good. What's going to happen to shrink this? Well, shrinking the valuation gap will take proactive actions on part of the management, as well as the controlling shareholders. Now, there are signs that this is already beginning. As I mentioned, they actually sold one of the indirect investments, LDK, which we haven't talked about because it's past tense. I mean, it was a sale that was brilliantly executed, brought in the better part of, I think, a few hundred million Australian dollars. Now they're working the Polish properties. So that's one item which has now been put up for sale. Again, these assets, the Polish assets, are up for detailed due diligence by potential acquirers. And then the other thing, which is quite important, they had begun the process of trying to bring the direct investments, which is the portfolio of office buildings in Australia, public via a listed REIT, or a listed entity, could be a REIT or a real estate investment company. This too, of course, has been temporarily shelved given the very rapid run-up in interest rates. But I suspect it really will get back. It'll be moved to the front burner as and when you experience some quiescence in interest rates. So now what do you expect, what do you see happening here? First of all, as they start to monetize and shrink the indirect investments, what this is going to do is, of course, one of the things, immediate byproducts is the balance sheet starts to improve. The second thing, of course, is once the direct investments are listed, you will have, they will have control of these things. They will garner management fees, but there will be further cash coming onto the balance sheet. What this is going to do, it's going to allow the company to start building its portfolio, free up resources to expand the real estate asset base for management. And now we will have a standalone asset management company, which currently has, there's zero, actually negative value attributed to it in the current valuation of the company, quite simply because it's there, it's buried in there, but it shouldn't be. And that is perhaps the most valuable part of the company right now, which is completely, you know, invisible to the naked eye. A comment I will make is the people at ARA were brilliant managers of real estate assets and real estate funds. And I think that is what they saw here. Buried deep inside this company, in a jumble of a bunch of fully owned buildings and partially owned investments in publicly listed funds, lay a very interesting asset manager. Now, what happens to this asset manager is hard to tell, but I suspect that, you know, we have ARA, which has now been bought itself by a company called ESR in Hong Kong, which is not going to let the grass grow under their feet. I suspect they will proactively move to realizing the values of this asset management business and or this company in its entirety. So, of course, as you can imagine, as this process moves forward of rationalizing, you know, the holdings, realizing the value latent in the holdings, it will improve the balance sheet quality, streamline the range of business activities, and the benefits of this are certainly going to inure to not just the controlling shareholders, but to all shareholders. I think I've probably overstepped my time a little bit, so let me pause over here and pass it back to you, John.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, Amit, for this interesting investment thesis. Let's see, where do we start? So the NTA that's published, does that basically give no consideration to the 11 billion AUM
That's
business?
Correct. Exactly. That's the big difference, yes.
Understood.
That's exactly. These are physical, these are tangible assets. So, you know, asset managers have very little in terms of net tangible assets, which is why it is not a part of the NTA. But ultimately, it actually does have a value because it's a income generating business, which will hopefully, post the rationalization of these assets, will be a growing business and will generate hopefully increasing cash flow streams. Again, it's a scale business. So incrementally, as dollars get added onto that, the margins on the incremental dollars being managed is really, really quite large. I mean, these businesses have very, very large margins, ROIs, and so on and so forth, and are valued quite differently from, say, physical assets, a la buildings, for example.
Of course, asset management businesses typically, I don't know if there's a kind of a range of AUM that's typical. I think what I've seen is, you know, 2-4% or so. Is that roughly what your experience has been? I believe you are showing about 4%.
Correct. Yeah. Now, what you have here is captive assets. So these assets can't pick up and run away. So assets that come and go, for example, if you are, say, managing mutual funds and so forth, it's probably worth a lot less than if you have these captive assets. So, I mean, that's one item. The other item is there is, if you will, the fixed costs of setting up such a thing, the infrastructure that goes into building an asset manager. While there are no physical assets per se, there is all the systems and IT and all that sort of stuff. So those are there. Now, as it grows in size, it will probably not, the percentage of AUM as a basis of valuation will probably fall. And the other item I will say is that, at current valuations, at current market valuations of the stock, there's a negative valuation being attributed to the asset management business, which is, pick a number, 2%, 3%, 4%, whatever you want to pick. You're not paying for it at all. Because you're trading
below,
you're buying below the NTA for that matter. So
makes sense. I was just looking through the ASX, the regulatory filings, and I believe they just filed the valuations update
On the 14th, yes.
Correct. Is that already in your numbers or should we reflect that somewhere?
So what I would say is, look, knock off a couple of cents, a nickel, for example, and you have a huge margin of safety. Okay, so you take the NTA down to 79, and you have a stock that's at 37.5 cents. Or the NAV, knock off a nickel, you're at 84 cents. And you're still, as I said, you're at 37.5 cents. So there is already a margin of safety, a massive margin of safety. I mean, there is a risk, and which is one of the reasons why the stock is as cheap as it is. There's a fear of higher interest rates. As interest rates rose multiple times, the cap rates rose. As the cap rates rose, the valuation declined, and so the valuation I've used, and this was done before this most recent press release happened, was one where it reflected all the way through June 2023. The other valuation that you're referring to knocks off, I think, probably, as I said, about a nickel or so, maybe less than a nickel, the change between June 2023 and December 2023. So you're talking about, let's say, 84 cents per share NAV versus a stock price of 37.5 cents.
Absolutely. And you mentioned controlling shareholder. Could you just elaborate on that? And
So the largest shareholder, originally the one that engaged in this big proxy fight, was ARA Asset Management. ARA Asset Management itself was taken over by ESR out of Hong Kong. ESR is another real estate asset manager. And again, I cannot tell you what their motivations are going to be. My guess is they will either want to own the real estate management business, the asset management part of this company, or probably sell it. Hard to say what their intentions are. That I do not know. ARA fought tooth and nail for 3 years to get on the board because they thought it was a ridiculously cheap thing. Look, I mean, when we started looking at this thing in 2021, the numbers that we would turn up in terms of NAVs were over a dollar and something, or $1.10 or something. Now, granted, it's gone down to 89 cents per share post the declines in valuations of the carrying values of various of the fixed assets, in part because of interest rates going up. But hard to say what ESR's motivations are. But the people that ARA installed are very, very high quality. I'd say not only do they know what they're doing, the person who's a chairman of the board is actually a brilliant investor in his own right. He's chairs and is the largest shareholder of another company in Australia called Ariadne Australia, and he does all sorts of special situations. And over the years, I've known said chair, Dr. Gary Weiss. I've probably known him for at least 20, 25 years. He's old school value investor and brilliant. He's an activist. He does not go out there looking for a fight, but will not run away from it. He's a lawyer by training and a very, very bright corporate lawyer. He basically did a clean sweep of the management. And I suspect, I think with all this in place, you have a process underway which will realize value for the shareholders. Exactly what ESR wants to do with this holding, I don't know, but it came as a part of their purchase of ARA Asset Management.
Wonderful. Well, that will conclude it for me. I would just encourage MOI Global members to feel free to follow up with any further thoughts or questions. Amit, as always, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to share your wisdom and ideas with the MOI Global community.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you very much for all of those who have been listening or will be listening prospectively. Thank you all. Thanks very much.
Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.